A technician turned from the control panel. He stared at Rourke. The man wore a corporal's rank, as did Rourke.
What is wrong, comrade?
Did you make the repairs?
Only a loose ground wire. It is fixed. She is ready to fly.
The technician smiled happily.
Good. Thanks for the quick service.
Why did you do that, comrade?
The technician rose to nearly his full, impressive height. The technician was also very fast. The man's right hand flicked out. Rourke jerked his head back and away from it, but not fast enough. Rourke stumbled back along the fuselage toward the open sliding doorway. The knife dropped from where he carried it up his sleeve. He started to move, but the technician was beside him in what seemed like a single stride. Rourke landed a punch to the red's gut. The technician smiled. The man's arm shoved out, the hands opening, thrusting outward from the chest like a basketball player's. Rourke felt himself flying out of the aircraft. Rourke felt the runway surface crash toward him, and he rolled, on his knees, up to his feet, his jaw numb. The technician bounded from the open fuselage doorway. Less than 2 yards apart, Rourke looked at the man. He was at least 7 feet tall. The technician's body of rippling muscle looked to have been poured into the fatigue uniform.
Vitamins?
The technician hurled himself forward. Rourke sidestepped and twisted half right, his left fist hammering out and down as the Soviet technician's body lurched past him. The technician's body hit the concrete, sprawling. Rourke's knuckles ached with the impact. The technician pushed himself up in a perfect one-hand push-up, bounding to his feet.
Not often a guy your size is so fast.
Very much. Thank you.
Anytime.
The big man threw himself forward again. Rourke realized he was trapped between the aircraft fuselage and his opponent. Rourke dropped, rolled under the fuselage, onto his knees and back up, the aircraft between them now. Natalia and Paul Rubinstein ran across the field, Natalia pushing the handcart loaded with crates of air-to-air and air-to-ground missiles, one of the liberated assault rifles blazing from her right hand. Rubinstein, the Schmeisser in his right fist, under his left arm a metal ammo box, his left fist closed on the handle of a second box.
I'm taking this machine! You and Natalia get airborne!
Rourke wheeled away from the technician's fist and tried to block the man's other hand as it cut under the block. But the blow landed against his abdomen and Rourke doubled forward. The technician fell back. Rourke dropped to his knees, his wind gone. The man's fist had connected with one of the twin stainless Detonix pistols Rourke had under his uniform blouse. The big man's left foot snapped out, but Rourke looked up just in time. Rourke's hands caught the big man's foot. Rourke went with its direction of motion, rolling, dragging the man down. Rourke shifted his own weight on his palms, his left leg snapping out. Rourke kicked again. Rourke shifted his weight again, wheeling, his right foot kicking out, missing as the technician rolled away, blood streaming from the right side of a massive man's mouth. Rourke edged back, half to his feet as the technician, on his knees, swung his left. Rourke dodged his head back as the technician's left fist just missed Rourke's chin. Rourke's own left hammered out. Rourke's right hooked up under the chin, the head snapping back again. Rourke threw himself forward from his knees, his left shoulder impacting the center of the giant's chest. The man toppled back with Rourke on top of him. The technician's head snapped into the tarmac. Rourke climbed to his feet, sagging against the helicopter fuselage, the gunfire loud now from all sides. He stared at the 7-foot-tall Soviet technician.
Best fight I've had in years.
John turned to climb into the bird. He could barely close his hands into bloody, knuckled fists. Blood seeped from his knuckles as Rourke worked the controls of the state-of-the-art Soviet helicopter. The video displays flashed to life before him. Printed words in Cyrillic alphabet streamed across the screens. He started memorizing the positioning of the readouts, airspeed indicator, altimeter, fuel consumption. At the same time, John Rourke could see black-clad KGB personnel filling the field, racing toward his machine, toward the machine Natalia and Paul Rubinstein commandeered. The soldiers ran in a wedge, assault rifles blazing, but the bullet-resistant windshield bubble surrounding him absorbed the hits. He had no idea what acceptable oil pressure and temperature readings would be, no idea what level of RPMs had to be reached. It would be guesswork only. Already, one of the 5 helicopters, neither he nor Natalia disabled, was skimming the ground, heading toward Natalia's ship.
Let's get the hell out of here!
Rourke gambled, starting airborne, the ship lurching, swaying left, mere inches over the surface of the field.
Come on, you son of a bitch!
Rourke thought he found the machine gun controls. A new display panel lit, the weapon systems panel. He wheeled the chopper 90 degrees to port, overcompensating, the machine shuddering, lurching downward. Rourke gave the main rotor more power. The ship climbed. Rourke's left thumb flipped the cover at the top of the control wheel. His left hand only gripping the yoke, his right hand working to adjust the mixture, his left thumb depressing the fire control button at the top of the yoke. He started the chopper climbing, leveling off at less than 50 feet over the runway surface as more accurate machine gun fire shot toward him from one airborne Soviet machine. Rourke pressed the fire control button again. The helicopter that attacked him veered hard starboard and climbed. Natalia's machine was airborne as well now, Rubinstein visible in the open fuselage doorway, one of the Soviet assault rifles in each hand now, both weapons firing toward the Soviets on the ground. Natalia's machine turned almost 360 degrees. There was a puff of off-white smoke, then a bleached white contrail. One of the still operable Soviet choppers exploded, a fireball of yellow and black belching skyward. Rourke cut his own machine 180 degrees, then started to climb. He found his missile controls. The display panel activated a targeting computer as well. Rourke found the switch to override it. As he hit the override switch, Natalia's machine opened fire on the airborne Soviet machine. A miss. The Soviet man chopper turning 180 degrees to fire. Rourke hit the override switch and lost the control panel.
Shit.
Rourke banked his bird as he punched up the missile control panel again, scanning the control readouts to override the targeting computer and fire on manual. Instead of hitting the override switch, he hit the switch marked manual. The targeting computer was off now, he thought, but the control panel was still illuminated. Sighting via the control panel, he lined up his starboard forward missile bank on the Soviet chopper, now pursuing Natalia and Paul Rubinstein. The Soviet pilot was banking hard, following Natalia's craft as she strafed another of the machines still on the ground. She was equally as good a pilot as he. But her miss with her missile was due to the targeting computer. The Soviet pilot would have known how to outfly it for just such a contingency should a machine fall into enemy hands. The Soviet pilot's machine was closing now, Natalia banking away from it, making another strafing run, knocking out at least a half dozen of the KGB troopers firing at her from the airfield. Rourke activated the firing interlock, his left hand over the fire control mechanism, his eyes glanced from the control panel, it looked like a video game, to the living target he wished to destroy. The enemy helicopter was under his sights. Rourke hit the firing mechanism.
Go get it.
The image of the enemy gunship seemed to flare on the screen as Rourke looked away. The enemy chopper, a ball of flame now, fell in bits and chunks toward the gunships still on the ground and the men firing from cover surrounding them. Rourke activated his radio switch.
Natalia, come in.
John, you got him.
Let's get the hell out of here. Follow me. Rourke out.
The sudden acceleration pressed him back into the seat. The new gunship was fast. A half dozen of them, possibly less, could pace out the returning Eden Project fleet as they started their landing patterns and destroy them. Behind him, as he stole a glance, the airfield was a sea of flames.
500 years. Has anything changed?
Helmut Sturm stood peering skyward through his goggles amidst a buffeting wind of rotor wash. The main armada of the Condor Squadron gunships approached from the southwest. The sight filled him with pride. His right hand rested on the full-flap holster at his right hip. The gun under the flap was an antique from another war, another age. It was the Walther P-38 9mm his ancestor carried through the Second World War in the service of the Third Reich. It still functioned with lethal precision. He had the ammunition custom made in one of the weapons workshops. There was one other relic of his ancestor. He left this with Helena for one of their sons to possess, to cherish. It was an iron cross presented to Helmut Sturm's ancestor by Adolf Hitler himself. The sky seemed dark as night as the Condor Squadron gunships, 100 strong, passed on. The wind generated by their combined rotor blades tore at his clothing, at his flesh, at his subordinates surrounding him, all battered by the wind and the sand.
It is as it should be.
Helmut Sturm began to walk to his own machine on the ground. The brief night passed as the 100 gunships flew on toward the northeast. A force moved ahead of them, a force that did not register on their radar screens, a force of considerably lesser size than their own. An advance guard saw it disappear beyond a mountain range, the force flying low, as if skimming the ground. Did it, too, search for life? The massive cargo aircrafts appeared on radar. They brought these strange ships, Sturm thought, and left them here. Invaders? He smiled. One invader now pursued another, the prize, the North American continent. But who were these invaders? Perhaps some surviving Americans reclaiming what was once theirs 5 centuries earlier. Or perhaps the Russians come to claim what they could out of the destruction they wrought. He boarded his machine, his uniform thick with sand, his goggles coated with it, his black machine coated with it. But to have seen what he saw, the power of National Socialism obscuring the sun, if his commander asked, he would contrive a reason for it, unless his commander could already guess.
Pilot, we must be on the way. Destiny awaits.
The machine began to rise.
Helicopters! Holy shit!
He started to run, glancing behind him and skyward. They were coming out of the sunset, dozens of them, all but obscuring the sunset as they came. He pulled the Stalker from his back, wheeled, leveled the scoped, long-barreled, stainless Ruger single action. Could they be friendly? Was firing at them starting something that might not start otherwise? He hesitated. Then the sand around him churned.
Shit!
The nearest of the choppers was 200 yards, and Knuckles swung the Stalker online, sighting through the 2X Leopold silver scope. The fuselage would be armored. The bubble dome would be bullet-resistant. But these were his very special hand loads. An increased powder charge backing a 300-grain bullet. His right thumb cocked the hammer, and he settled the scope on the bubble dome of the lead black helicopter. Michael triggered the shot, the Stalker bucking hard into the web of his hand, the muzzle climbing. But the lead helicopter immediately began to bank, steeply, rising suddenly. More gunfire pounding the sand around him as Michael started running again. He had hit the machine, inflicted some damage. The Stalker, clenched in his right fist, he ran toward the trucks and the bulldozer.
The generator! Cut the generator so they can't see our lights!
Clouds of sand rose in waves on each side of him as he ran on. The helicopter gunships were nearly on top of him. Who were they? He guessed that somehow the clue to their identity lay in the identity of the downed pilot whose trail led him into the cannibal camp, led him to find Madison and save her. Madison, the girl who was now his wife in every way but ceremony, the girl who carried his child. He could see Annie coming out of the shelter, strapping her gun belt to her waist as the tent flap opened again and Madison exited the tent behind her.
Run for it! Run!
A burning feeling consumed his body, then a numbness in his legs and arms as his body pitched forward. He could see Annie firing her Scoremaster skyward toward the advancing machines. He wanted to shout to her it was useless, but his mouth wouldn't work. He tasted sand against his lips and on his tongue. Sand rippled along the ground on both sides of him. He closed his eyes. There was no pursuit.
Ah, the hell with caution. Let's just get home the fastest way we can.
John Rourke took the most direct route toward the encampment in southern Georgia, near the highway that would serve as a landing strip for the Eden Project fleet. Throughout the flight, in the jet-powered helicopters, it took just 3 hours, he flexed his fingers so his hands would still work properly, the pain increasing in the aftermath of the fight with the giant Soviet technician. Rourke throttled down, checking the airspeed indicator.
I'm going to the same frequency as the Beechcraft. We're only a few miles away, and maybe Michael or Annie will pick us up. You do the same, Natalia. Rourke out.
Roger on that. Natalia out.
Rourke punched the right keys, the frequency numbers appearing in red digital readout on the communications console.
This is John Rourke. Come in, base. Over. Annie, Michael, we're on the way home. We may have some company after a while, but all's well for the moment. Come back. Over. Hey, this is Dad. Let's hear from you. Over.
John, let me try. Natalia to base. Natalia to base. Come in. Over.
Natalia. After all these years, that voice, it still excites me. And Dr. Rourke, the memories your voice brings back.
Vladimir.
Rourke licked his lips. John Rourke's hands shook. In his left hand, he held the portable transceiver from the helicopter, the frequency open to the second Soviet chopper, which hovered in the bright moonlight less than a quarter mile away from where Rourke had landed. Natalia and Paul Rubinstein were aboard the second craft. There was no more transmission from Vladimir Karamazov, the man John Rourke thought he killed 5 centuries ago, the man who once was Natalia's husband. The man who nearly killed her, almost beat her to death before she resisted. In John Rourke's right hand was the Soviet assault rifle. He still wore the Soviet uniform, but his twin stainless Detonics pistols were exposed now, tucked between the black fatigue uniform's trousers and blouse. His own clothes were aboard the second helicopter.
Michael? Annie? Sarah! Sarah!
He kept walking, toward the tent, toward the Ford pickup truck, toward the other vehicles. The earth mover was silent. The landing strip nearly cleared. Michael made the work go faster than Rourke thought possible.
Sarah! Madison! Kurunami! Dr. Halverson!
John, what's happening? Over.
Nothing, Paul. How's Natalia? Over.
She's flying the chopper. She hasn't said a word. Over.
Stay by the radio, Paul. Work out.
He kept walking.
Madison! Michael! Answer me!
John Rourke stopped before the tent flap. There was no light from inside the tent.
Inside! Anybody there?
Rourke pulled back the tent flap with the muzzle of the Soviet rifle, catching the flap's edge on the front sight assembly. He clicked on the flashlight from the Soviet chopper and swept the beam across the tent floor to the far side. In a chair, his trousers drenched with blood, his shirt saturated with it, his face white like death, was his son.
Oh, Jesus.
John Rourke dropped the flashlight, watching the light as it rolled across the tent floor, his shaking left hand finding the radio transceiver, raising it close to his lips.
This is John Rourke.
John, what?
Stay off, Paul. Karamazov, do you hear me? Do you hear me, Karamazov? This time, motherfucker, I'll rip your guts out with my bare hands, and I'll burn them so you never come back!
Natalia watched John's eyes. Sweat beaded around them. She took the folded bandana handkerchief, wiped his brow, and daubed near his eyes. She watched John Rourke's rubber-gloved hands, stained red with the blood of his son, whose life he was trying to save. Natalia knew John would save Michael Rourke if anyone could. He saved her life, surgically and otherwise. It was because of the otherwise that she looked toward the tent flap.
Paul, come inside, please.
Paul Rubinstein stepped into the tent.
What is it?
I have something I must do. You don't need to guard from outside. My husband won't be coming yet, if at all. He knows what to expect, and so do I. You attend John. Give him the help he needs. Go scrub. You know how. He taught us both.
Forget that.
Paul, you had better do as I say, or otherwise John won't have help for a few critical moments. I have to leave.
Bullshit.
What are you talking about?
I have someone to meet.
They've got Annie and Sarah. They've got Madison, and maybe she's got my grandchild in her. They've got Kurunami, and they've got Halverson. They're not getting you.
They haven't got anyone, John. It's Vladimir. And there are only two people Vladimir would allow close enough to him to kill him. You and me.
John Rourke looked up from Michael's right kidney.
Paul, she tries to leave here. Kneecap her if you have to.
What? Hey, I...
Do it!
Rourke looked back to his surgery.
I love you very deeply, Paul. You are my finest friend. Don't make me hurt you.
Talk about ego deflating. Look, we'll get Michael patched up, and then we'll all go after Karamazov and get everyone back and take care of...
John must attend his son or Michael will die. After that, someone will need to be with Michael constantly while John flies one of the helicopters to destroy the bridges so the space shuttles can land. One of the two of you will have to work the earth mover to clear the debris. Michael can't be left alone. That leaves me.
She spoke to Paul Rubinstein, but she looked now at John Rourke.
I won't let you go.
I love you, too. But Paul, try as he might, couldn't stop me without killing me, and he would never do that. And you can't lay down your surgical instruments to stop me without killing your only son. I'm leaving.
Paul!
Hey, look, Natalia!
Her left hand flashed forward to his windpipe, a short-duration pinch. Paul's hands reached up to her hand as she applied downward pressure to temporarily interrupt the flow of blood in the subclavian artery. Paul's body sagged to its knees, and she cushioned his head with her hands as she rested it on the floor of the tent.
He should be awake in a few moments, John. A few moments after that, and he will be good as new.
Natalia, you can't...
She stood, walked over to the improvised operating table, and took John Rourke's face in her hands. She kissed him hard on the lips.
Natalia, I'll find another
way. No, you won't find another way, John.
She stopped to look at him.
I love you. You can't.
That's why I can.
She looked at John Rourke once more, walked out through the tent flap and into the bright moonlight. She stripped off her pistol belt. She would not need her guns, and someone else could use them. Perhaps John would keep them as a remembrance of her. She reached the Ford pickup, set the gun belt on the seat beside Michael's unused guns. Sarah's gun, Annie's gun, the stock government model Colt 45 of Dr. Halverson, Kurunami's identical pistol, Michael's 44 Magnum single-action Rugers, all the M16s, she could see them neatly set out in the truck bed. Vladimir left them as a sign of contempt. She knew they were useless against him. She reached into the hip pocket of her black jumpsuit. The Balisong knife came alive in her hand like a butterfly, folding and unfolding its wings. It was childish, but she inverted the knife in her hand and stabbed it into the top of the Ford's dashboard, leaving it there, the handle halves closing around it. She stared at the night sky, starting to walk toward her helicopter. While John prepared Michael for surgery, she had emptied the gunship of all armament. She needed transportation only to death. Natalia Anastasia Temerovna, Major, Committee for the State Security of the Soviet, looked at the moon.
I am coming, Vladimir, and I will have to do.
She wished for a cigarette. She turned on the headset microphone.
This is Major Temerovna. Talk me into your position. I wish to converse privately with my husband. Over.
Comrade Major, we have you on our radar. Course correction adjustments to follow. Stand by on this frequency. Out.
She stared ahead. The moonlight was nearly gone. It would be many hours before John Rourke concluded the operation to save his son's life. 59 hours had passed. 64 hours, plus or minus 1 hour, remained until the Eden Project fleet would have to land. It was evident to her now Vladimir Karamazov knew where to find them. He received radio transmissions outlining what happened near the site of the womb, projected their course, and beat them to their destination. He assumed Michael would die, that both she and John Rourke would come to him.
John!
She closed her eyes for an instant, thanking God Michael was only wounded, that John had not lost his son, and that John was, because of his son's condition, powerless to prevent her actions. The viewscreen came alive, giving the course correction. She set her instruments accordingly, mechanically, wondering how it would be. Would he attempt to kill her instantly? She anticipated now that he would torture her, make her beg for death. That would perhaps give her the time she needed to free Sarah, Annie, Madison, and the others, and then to kill him.
Vladimir, you sad, sick creature.
She must move quickly to prevent her husband from having the time to once again attack the camp where John now labored to save his son's life, to prevent Colonel Vladimir Karamazov from killing John and Paul, and if Michael lived, undoing his father's work.
I have the coordinates. ETA 20 minutes. I shall expect to be met. Major Temerovna, out.
She knew perfectly well she would be. She knew her destination, the mountains of northeastern Georgia, very close to the retreat itself. More of her husband's sense of drama. Natalia Anastasia Temerovna stood before her helicopter, an officer and two assault rifle-armed enlisted personnel running toward her. She watched them, her hands on her hips. She recognized the officer, Captain Popovsky. Popovsky stood tall, thin, and young. Despite the 5 centuries since last she saw him, since he last snapped to attention and saluted her.
Comrade Major Temerovna.
She nodded, not returning the red-haired man's salute. She gave her last salute to valiant Russians centuries ago and would not sully its meaning now.
Captain, you look well. I seem to remember that you smoked. You do not still, do you?
Yes, Comrade Major. I am ashamed to admit that I do.
May I have a cigarette?
Yes, Comrade Major. We make some few cigarettes. They are like American cigarettes were, I think.
He extended a silver cigarette case, and Natalia reached into it, taking one of the cigarettes.
Corporal, the Comrade Major cigarette.
The corporal, to Popovsky's right, stepped forward quickly, his rifle swinging pendulum fashion at his side. It was not like American cigarettes, but satisfactory. She promised herself that if somehow she lived, she would smoke through at least a package of the cigarettes at the retreat. Then she would quit again.
Thank you, Corporal.
She smiled at him, holding back her laughter. He stared at her as the match burned down to his finger.
Ouch!
The corporal stomped the match on the ground, beneath the sunrise shadows of the mountains around them, and stepped back to stand behind and beside Captain Popovsky.
I wish to see my husband, Colonel Karamazov. He still calls himself Colonel, not Marshal or something.
The Comrade Colonel is interested in seeing the Comrade Major as well.
Popovsky nodded, grimly, she thought.
I'm sure he is.
For 500 years, she had not smoked.
If you would come this way, Comrade Major.
Popovsky began to walk beside her, gesturing them up the relatively flat valley floor and into the rocks. She walked ahead, Popovsky to her left and slightly behind her.
Comrade Major, I only inquired to know the strength of our enemy.
Your enemy?
Yes, Comrade Major. But the man the Comrade Colonel left behind in the chair, the man bled badly and...
He lives.
She looked at Popovsky and thought she saw the flicker of a smile in his eyes. He nodded, saying nothing.
Your new gunships are quite advanced.
I wish that I had the abilities to fly one of the machines, Comrade Major.
Perhaps someday.
She smiled, looking toward the tents set along the base of the mountain she approached. One was larger than all the others, centrally located. It would be her husband's tent.
The prisoners. The prisoners my husband took after the young man was shot. They are well, Popovsky?
Yes, Comrade Major. The young woman with the very long hair.
Yes?
She required 3 men to subdue her.
He looked down at his feet. Natalia let herself smile. She would not identify Annie as Rourke's daughter. Her husband might wish to torture and kill anyone named Rourke. She asked the question of Popovsky.
What has he planned for me?
Popovsky stopped. Natalia stopped.
You should not have come, Comrade Major. He does horrible things to women. There are wild tribes in Europe. He takes their women, beats them to death, rapes them, and I do not know, Comrade Major. But you would be wise to kill yourself first.
I cannot. I brought no weapons.
I am sorry, Comrade Major. Truly. Were there a God, I would pray to him for you.
I do believe there is a God, Andre. And I thank you.
Paul Rubinstein felt like this once before in his life. He felt like this when he realized New York was gone, and with it, the girl to whom he was engaged, the girl to whom he promised his love. Now, Paul Rubinstein saw Annie Rourke's face in the rising sun. Did Karamazov kill her, or do worse? Rubinstein knew Colonel Vladimir Karamazov well by reputation. The night Paul and Natalia shared a fire's warmth in the middle of a blizzard, Natalia spoke of what Karamazov did to her. Now, Natalia, too, was lost to Paul. But how? Karamazov was dead. Hadn't Paul Rubinstein watched through the scope of Rourke Steyr Mannlicher SSG as Rourke faced him down and shot him? Was Karamazov some devil who could not die?
If I didn't know better, I'd think Karamazov was Lucifer himself.
Paul thought of Michael Rourke. John Rourke removed 7 bullets from his son's back, one of the bullets very close to the spine, 2 of the bullets nearly penetrating the right kidney. The loss of blood was the greatest enemy. Rourke gave 2 pints of his own blood to his son and was so weak that Rubinstein was forced, under John Rourke's direction, to finish closing the incisions. Michael rested now, but could not be moved. John Rourke lay in an exhausted sleep. Paul Rubinstein alternately watched the wounded, the sleeping, and the horizon for aircraft. He was powerless to attempt to rescue Annie or Sarah or any of the others. When John Rourke woke, before any plans could be laid, the bridges would have to be blown and the improvised runway surface cleared. And at any moment, Karamazov might attack.
We were so close.
The majority of the sand was already cleared, but the bridges stood. Would Karamazov wait until the 6 craft of the Eden Project fleet were in the landing process, then attack and shoot them down? Was it lack of sleep for Paul? Lack of knowing what to do, or forced inaction that opened the door to fear? Without blood, Michael's recovery would be slow at best. Without John Rourke, should one of the wounds become infected, Michael would die.
Damn it!
Paul Rubinstein looked to the sunrise and clenched the Schmeisser tighter in his fists. Sarah Rourke, her wrists bleeding, twisted her left hand so she could touch at the knot. The handkerchief used to gag her, wet from her own saliva, now sagged below her chin. She was the only one of them who had worked her gag free.
These guys must have spent 500 years learning how to tie ropes tight.
They were placed in the tent so long ago, Sarah lost count of the hours. They lay with hands and ankles tied. They had been gagged, their hands tethered to stakes driven deep into the rocky ground beneath the tent. Annie's eyes were still closed. The place where the rifle butt hit her jaw was darkening, purple now. Madison only stared. But Madison had been a good girl, Sarah reflected, trying to defend Annie, after Annie was subdued, trying unsuccessfully to block the blow of the rifle butt. Kuranami's face reflected his struggle as well. It took more than a half dozen of the KGB assault troops to subdue the young Japanese naval aviator. Then Kuranami, hands and feet held by one man per limb, was beaten in the face and the abdomen. His lips were puffy. Dried blood accumulated under the mouth and along the line of his jaw on the left side. His left eye half-closed and blackened. But Kuranami as well was working on his ropes. Sarah watched him. Elaine Halverson had emptied her pistol, then clawed with her nails at one of her attackers. But an assault rifle pressed against her head forced her surrender. Now Elaine, too, fought her ropes.
Michael.
Elaine Halverson worked her gag nearly free, rubbing her chin against the rock surface beneath her, her chin rubbed raw of skin in spots and bleeding.
If John hasn't come for us by now, that must mean Michael was still alive, and John is working to save him. We may have help coming. In any event, Paul or Natalia.
Elaine Halverson was finally free of the gag.
Natalia, but this madman, Karamazov, he's her.
I know, he's her husband. John thought he killed Karamazov before the Holocaust. Michael told me about it, but it doesn't matter.
I didn't think...
That I liked Natalia? You've seen it. She's in love with my husband. My husband's in love with her. But I don't question the fact that she's on our side. Karamazov tried killing her once, almost beat her to death. He's an animal. I won't say I don't like her. I will say I don't like the situation, Elaine. Believe me, if Natalia wanted me out of the way, I wouldn't be here. She's the one who prepared the injections when we took the cryogenic sleep. She helped John find me, and find the children. She's, well, she is... But if John hadn't gotten here by now, that means Paul or Natalia, both of them will be on the way. We might not have the time. Ow!
Sarah tugged at the knot, breaking one of her already short nails, but the knot loosened.
Might not have the time to wait. It must be morning by now.
Sarah Rourke began working on the next part of the knot, having no idea if there were more knots to undo. She kept working, and a smile crossed her lips. O'Rourke didn't give up. John Rourke's face was drawn and his hands looked swollen. Paul Rubenstein watched as Rourke stepped from the tent. The familiar double Alessi shoulder rig carrying the twin stainless Detonix pistols was across his shoulders. The flap holster with the Metalifed and Magnaported 6-inch Colt Python hung at his right hip. On his left hip, he wore one of the long-bladed Gerber MK2 fighting knives, the most recent addition to John Rourke's armament. For some reason, Paul Rubenstein felt compelled to stand.
How's Michael?
He's very weak, but I can't do anything about that beyond what I've done. I can't transfuse any more blood to him and still be able to function myself. It occurred to me as I had all the time in the world to work on Michael that Karamazov didn't attack again because he wants the Eden Project to land so that he can use those choppers to shoot them down. That's why he didn't smash the radio set. I'm half surprised he didn't blow down those bridges for us just to speed it up, because that's what we've got to do now. I'm getting that Russian chopper airborne.
Can we get back to preparing the landing strip?
Yeah. I'll blow the bridges with some of the missiles, then take up the pickup truck from the supply cache and head after Natalia, try to spring the others, and try to keep Natalia from getting killed. You'll have to work the earth mover, bulldoze the debris clear from the highway, then signal the shuttles to land. I already used the radio, told Commander Dodd what happened. They saw some other airborne activity. It's in Alabama. Maybe more the Russians, I don't know. I can't worry about it either. The shuttles have to land. We get them down a little sooner, all the better for Michael. They have plasma, and some of the fleet's complement has the same blood type as Michael. Sarah has the same blood type, and so does Annie. Whatever happens, we're giving Michael a chance.
Paul Rubenstein looked at his friend.
I wish I was going with you.
I wish you were too. But what you've got to do here is more important. I've got to finish the job I started 5 centuries ago. If I'd put a few bullets through Karamazov's brain then, none of this would have happened. I should have planned ahead. But damn, I thought he was dead.
John Rourke studied the tip of his shoe, and Rubenstein watched.
I won't make the same mistake again.
Rourke started toward the helicopter. When Natalia entered the tent, Vladimir Karamazov simply stared at her, and she stood before his desk, waiting. She had been waiting now a full 10 minutes. She left her Rolex with her other things. Perhaps Annie or Madison could use them. Finally, Karamazov raised the pistol from his desk and pointed it at her face.
Andres, Natalia.
She closed her eyes and began, slowly, because she knew that was how he wanted it, to strip her clothes from her body. The boots were gone now, as were the black leather gloves she wore, and on the tent floor beside them, the one-piece black jumpsuit. She balanced herself as she removed first the left, then the right black boot sock, letting these fall to the floor as well. She wore nothing but a lace-trimmed beige silk teddy. Slowly, she edged down first one shoulder strap, then the other, pushing the garment down past her waist and past her hips, her breasts exposed to him. She shuddered, her whole body exposed to him as she let the teddy fall around her ankles, then stepped out of it and back from it. She opened her eyes.
Why did you come here willingly?
To get close enough to you that I can kill you myself and end this.
Even at the cost of your own life, you will never see John Rourke again, Natalia.
I know that. And yes, at the cost of my own life. Some things are more important than life, Vladimir.
I agree.
His eyes held madness. She saw the night he beat her so many years ago.
For example, pleasure is more important than life. The life of someone else, at least. And for 5 centuries, even while I slept, do you know that I dreamed of it? But for all those years, I wanted no pleasure more than I wanted to destroy you. Just a piece at a time. You won't die. Not yet. That would be pointless. I have medical experts who can keep you alive despite the pain. Despite the... despite all of it. I want to make you beg to die. And then, of course, I won't let you die. That would ruin it all. I have experimented ever since my awakening with whips, clubs, electrodes, hot irons, with all the devices I could think of to cause pain to a woman. If there were still other living creatures besides men on Earth, oh, there are things I could do to you that would delight me and make you scream until your throat bled with it, until you could never utter another sound. But yet, you would still go on screaming.
He smiled again.
But other things we'll have to do. And Rourke, he will come for you and for all the others, whoever they are. I know the one I left for him was his son. No two men could look so alike unless twin brothers or father and son. He played games with the cryogenic chambers, didn't he?
Natalia nodded.
One of those two girls is his daughter. Never mind telling me now. You'll tell me later. And the woman. That is the legendary Sarah for whom he searched. I'll try her myself and let you know how good the competition was, darling. And the daughter, too. Then many of the men would surely like to have them. And the black woman, a novelty for my men. And perhaps for some of the women, too. And the Japanese, well, yeah, we shall let him give us a show. He's very good with the martial arts. We can let him fight to the death. That should be amusing to us all. I'll let you watch while Sarah and Rourke's daughter and the black woman are raped. And the other girl, too. I'll enjoy your reaction. After weeks of abusing your body, your mind, your very spirit, when death is all that you crave, I have devised a most ingenious method, but slow. In this new atmosphere of ours, the sun is stronger. We'll take you out to the height of a great mountain, where the sun shines brightly, and let your flesh burn and rot from your body while you still live. An experience to look forward to, hmm?
He smiled again. She calculated the distance to the other side of the desk. If she failed, he would kill her. If she succeeded, she would kill him. She knew he had calculated it. She threw herself forward, his pistol a blur as it moved upward toward her face, her right hand clawing for his neck, her left hand drawn back, the heel of it aimed toward the base of his nose.
Die!
She felt a sudden pain across her back, her body sagging, the blow from the heel of her left hand deflected by her husband's right arm, then pain again at the base of her skull, the blackness and the coldness washed over her. John Rourke dropped his altitude, coming low toward the bridge so he could fire at the inside of the bridge supports, blowing most of the debris away from the road rather than onto it. He counted under his breath, reaching 3 before he was able to go for altitude. At 5, the concussion from the 2 explosions made the machine shudder around him, the controls not responding for an instant, the tail spinning wildly. With a relaxed hand at the tiller, Rourke regained control and moved away from a fireball uncomfortably close, belching skyward. Heat from the fireball seared the plexiglass, or its more modern equivalent. Rourke throttled out, glancing beneath him once as the fireball separated from its source. The bridge was all but disintegrated. He followed the course of the road because the shuttlecraft would have to follow it on landing. The second bridge already nearly dead ahead. The Soviet gunship responded well enough, but it was not human-engineered to his tastes. He began decelerating, arming another missile complement. John Rourke's head ached from the loss of blood at twice the accepted amount to save his son. His hands were stiff, pained when he moved them. But he could still pull a trigger. Rourke flew toward the second bridge.
1, 2, 3.
The helicopter climbed again, Rourke banking, turning the machine a full 180 degrees. The second bridge, like the first, was no more. In the distance, Paul Rubinstein was already bringing up the Earth Mover. John Rourke banked again, dropping altitude to skim over the sand, blowing sand from the highway surface with the rotor downdraft. Once he finished this task, he'd get in the pickup and head after his family. The Detonic Scoremasters he took from the place were in the pickup truck. His wife's Trapper Scorpion, his daughter's Scoremaster, Halverson's 1911 A1, Kuranami's government model, and Natalia's things. The Rolex watch, the Balisong knife, the twin Metalife custom L-frames. John Rourke closed his eyes. He saw Vladimir Karamazov's face. Sarah Rourke tugged. Still, the knot did not give way. She looked at Dr. Elaine Halverson. Halverson shrugged.
I can't get it.
She looked past Elaine Halverson. Akira Kuranami had been sitting upright for some 20 minutes, his legs no longer straight ahead of him. He squatted on his haunches instead. His eyes, wide open, stared as if in a trance, the left eye visibly bloodshot in the light of the propane lamp.
Akira!
Kuranami's eyes never flickered. Sarah Rourke watched. Each muscle in Kuranami's legs and arms and chest seemed to ripple under the dirt-stained white jumpsuit he wore, the NASA patch half ripped from it. Kuranami's chest rose and fell more rapidly. His lips drew back, baring his teeth around the gag, the muscles around his eyes twitching.
Akira!
No, a friend of John's. Before the night of the war, he used to call that summoning up chi.
What?
He's focusing all his energy, all his strength.
To rip apart the ropes?
I don't think so. Wait.
Sarah Rourke watched. Kuranami's face was going pale. She wondered if it were physically possible for a human being to control blood flow, to divert blood. Kuranami's eyelids flickered. He looked about to faint.
Akira!
Kuranami's entire body seemed to twitch, to half lift from the ground. Kuranami's body snapped up, twisting and wrenching. He had ripped the spike from the rocky ground, his hands still bound. He rolled across the floor toward Sarah. The spike was still in his hands. He looked at her. Sarah Rourke felt herself smile.
You want me to work the knots with my teeth?
Kuranami, gagged still, nodded vigorously. Sarah Rourke smiled again.
Get close to me. Elaine, you work your own knots. Hurry.
Kuranami wriggled into position. Sarah began chewing at the knots binding his wrists. Sarah Rourke hoped someone aboard the Eden Project was a dentist, just in case.